Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents The Shadows of Empty Men by A.D. Davies, narrated by Nigel Patterson. Prologue. There are no ghosts. That's what we're told when our fears burrow too deep. If our friends or children suffer nightmares, we repeat the mantra, "There are no ghosts." We know it's true because everything has a rational explanation. Except human nature. Humans are the most illogical beings, full of terror, hate, and urges the worst of people cannot explain, even when it surfaces within themselves. Like those whose profession is death. They and we can only guess at what drives them, what allows them to switch off the part of their brain that for most other people refuses to kill another. For them, such an act feels as empty as closing a door. Kill, get paid. Close the door, keep the draft out. Same synapses firing, same degree of guilt. Then there are those who choose their profession for other reasons. A man once said, to be truly happy, you need to become an expert at something you love, because when you are an expert, better than most of the population at any activity, someone will eventually pay you to do it. Computer games, singing, playing a sport. Find your expertise, utilize those skills for your living, and be happy. The same holds true for murder. Do you enjoy inflicting pain and death upon your fellow humans? Then do it a lot. Get good at it. Become great at it. And soon you can earn your living doing what you love. But if you encounter another who is also adept at killing, yet does not share your pleasure, you will be drawn into conflict. You will be called to account for your actions, and a person like me will do everything humanly possible to stop you striking ever again. I have learned over the past year that I am able to kill. I gain no pleasure from it, but I am willing. Although I would struggle to justify certain actions to a judge, or even my friends, I sleep fine, and I only regret my mistakes. Mistakes primarily concerning not acting quickly enough, allowing bad men to take the lives of innocents around me. So when a case comes my way, seemingly peaceful, research-based, I may not be prepared. How can I be? For a job such as this, I would not plan on unleashing the bestial side of me. For when a killer of real passion enters my life, I cannot turn away. As ever, when I have no choice, I will act. There are no ghosts in this world, except those we make for ourselves. Greece, the island of Parramatta. Chapter 1. Have you ever visited a Greek island in the springtime? The air you breathe is actually sweet. The colours are orange and green, white and red. The sunrise is somehow both lazy and fierce. Perhaps that's why I found it so hard to leave. Varying my routes through the hilly island, my morning runs had grown longer of late, starting earlier thanks to sleeping with my curtains open so I rise via natural light. One grain-based bar and a glass of water, and I'm out of the door, returning anywhere between an hour and 2 hours later, depending on my mood. This morning saw a two-hour jaunt out to the Akara ruins, an amphitheatre predating the birth of Christ and overlooking a swooping crescent of cliff pulled apart by some long-forgotten earthquake. The dive boats were out already. Thanks to my injection of cash to the Archaeological Society of Parramatta, yep, ASP, small teams were currently exploring the local legend of a vast city that once stood out there, grand and proud, before the same shifting of plates 5 miles wide swallowed it up, along with the coastline. The more excitable of their members were talking about Atlantis, but to date we had only recovered a dozen or so pots, which the big museums fobbed off with the notion that, despite being confirmed as genuine antiques, these items can be found all over the Aegean. They did not constitute evidence of a civilization. I joined them 3 or 4 times a week, and because of my financing, they tolerated my amateurish enthusiasm every time I surfaced, flashing a wide smile through my beard and waving what usually turns out to be a tide-smoothed Coke bottle to which a family of barnacles might have grown rather attached. I mostly try to keep out of their way and enjoy the scenery. It's springtime in the ocean, too. Yeah, I know. Feeling sorry for me yet? My return route cut through a village stirring to life, and I arrived home by 7:30, where I showered, trimmed my beard to keep it tight to my face to fend off the prospect of being mistaken for a hobo, and then sat on my house's second-floor balcony overlooking the rocky bay for a breakfast of bread, meat, yogurt and fruit. I caught up with the British news via various websites, skipping the more depressing-sounding stories, and briefly checked a couple of US sites in which I held a vague interest. Local news officially confirmed something I already learned from the chief of police. Deals between the EU and other countries meant incoming Middle Eastern and African refugees were now processed faster in Turkey, with the reduced number of traffickers diverted to islands further west. Parramatta's intake had reduced to a trickle. I clicked off the news feeds and nipped out to meet Eric Jones at the infinitely delayed airport construction site, where we planned to fire high-calibre handguns at various targets for a while. He was late, which wasn't unusual. It was so not unusual that I'd taken to bringing a book with me for such occasions. After setting up the tin cans and glass bottles I collected from the beach on the way over, I found my current place in John Connolly's latest and settled comfortably in the cab of a stalled JCB digger. Last November, the case that brought me here went on longer than I expected, legal wrangling demanding my continued presence weeks after its conclusion. Instead of returning to the UK, I secured a plush house with a panoramic view, and with my gut still in knots over the actions I took, or didn't take, I spent Christmas alone. New Year's Eve saw me hit it off with a retired British Army officer, the aforementioned Eric, and we ended up drinking expensive scotch in a bar right on the beach. I did not go home with Eric. I went home with a German blonde woman, 22 years old, making her 15 years my junior, although she taught me a few things, and I was happy to learn. Eric showed an hour late, hungover and red in the face. He'd piled on the pounds since his retirement, but he knew his guns. I didn't want to know guns, but there had been too many incidents lately where I could have used a lot more experience. I had made enough enemies after all. "You look like crap," I said. "We can't all roll out of bed coiffed and groomed like a GQ cover model, oh beautiful one. Here, you need some practice with this." He presented me with a Sig Sauer P229, a compact 40-caliber pistol. "No Glock today?" I asked. "You want to be good at firing everything, just in case, right?" "Right. So you tell me just in case of what, and I'll tell you what the best gun is for a given scenario." "I honestly hope never to have to fire one at all, but..." He pressed the Sig into my hand. "Then if you're not going to own a firearm, get used to as many different types as possible. This is your bum gun, the one you got most trouble with." Using a Glock 16, I could draw and shoot a tight three grouping at 20 feet in one smooth motion, but the Sig's second and third shots went wild. The shift from its initial double action to single always threw me. Eric opened a premium quality camera bag to reveal four mags and two boxes of bullets. "You owe me €300 for the brass. Now get practicing. I'll be over there in the shade. Shout if you want a hug or something." What we were doing here wasn't exactly legal, but when Eric first moved out here with his wife, he registered himself as a gun collector and sportsman, so for a premium import tax he was able to source bullets for his toys. The chief knew of our practice sessions, though, and after what happened here over the winter, he allowed me some leeway. The real reason Eric kept himself so well armed lay in his past, and no amount of alcohol would pry it from his lips. He attempted the same line of questioning on me and achieved the same wall of silence. Eventually, we both stopped trying. I strapped on my holster, donned the ear protectors, and spent the next hour accounting for the differential in double and single action. Occasionally, Eric popped over to adjust my shoulders or the angle of my elbow and wrists, and when we ran out of inanimate objects to destroy, he drew faces on flat scraps of wood and mounted them on the wall of rubble serving as our range. 300 rounds later, my hands ached, but I thought I had the action down pat. "Better," Eric said. "This is almost the same mechanism as the Beretta, so I'll bring one of those tomorrow. 9mm makes the recoil a bit different, and the Beretta doesn't have a decocking hammer." "Thanks. I handed over 500 euros for the bullets and his fee for the week. Coffee?
The posh stuff you bring over from South America.
Of course, I said. It made a nice change to have a mentor who appreciated the finer side of life for a change. Eric schooled me in instruments of death, while I educated him in fine beans. Back at my house, I opened the mailbox, an American-style container at the end of the path, and sifted through the usual assortment of junk. Only a single item looked official.
Another one? Eric said.
Yeah. I opened it and read the admonishment from London-based attorneys Dunleavy, Smith and Clark about how I should not ignore them and how they were being fair in giving me a chance to respond to their clients' demands for compensation. Roger Gorman, my former partner in Park Avenue Investigations, blamed me for the fire that wiped out the profitable core of the business and demanded restitution to the tune of 10 times my actual wealth, even though the police cleared me of any involvement. To be fair, the police came to an incorrect conclusion, but to be equally fair, Gorman was still a dickhead. I'll sort it somehow. Rather than wiping my arse on it and sending it back in a perfumed envelope, which I almost did with the first notification, I folded the papers in half and placed them in my back pocket. My choices were to stand and fight, or move my money offshore and migrate to a country with no extradition. It didn't sit well with me. After I turned 18, I lived abroad for a long time, always moving around, finding a new perch to lay my proverbial hat, but that was born from my craving for isolation, for freedom, and simple joy. If I fled this, it would be a prison sentence. Eric followed me inside and immediately ducked into the downstairs loo, while I continued through the open-plan ground floor to my kitchen to recycle the junk mail accompanying Gorman's missive. Limited offer timeshares, a mayoral election flyer, the former resident's pre-approved credit card waiting for her.
Adam!
It was Eric's voice. I scanned around and found him in my lounge holding the Sig Sauer on an elderly white man and a miserable-looking black guy in his 30s. The older man wore a quality suit, the younger a leather jacket, white T-shirt and jeans. Eric must have used the facilities and headed straight for the airy living area, expecting me to deliver a steaming espresso of fair trade Guatemalan nectar, which I would have if not for this little wrinkle in my day.
One of them's packing, Eric said, his shooting stance not wavering an inch. Wanna guess which?
I strode across the polished marble toward the two men with their hands behind their heads, slapped open the younger guy's jacket and relieved him of a make of gun I'd never encountered. I located the safety to ensure it was on and tossed it aside. Faced the older guy. He was in his 60s or a very healthy 70s.
I said, I'm guessing you're the boss, he's the bodyguard.
Correct, the elderly man replied with an accent. German, I thought, but not pure. Belgian or Swiss, perhaps.
If I may, what you may do is tell me why you're here. Roger Gorman using scare tactics now. I assure you, I do not know who Roger Gorman is. We are here on an unrelated matter.
That forces you to break into my home. The door was locked when I got here. The man indicated the couch where an impression suggested he'd been waiting moments earlier. I nodded and he sat, but I waved a hand at Eric to remain alert.
Who are you?
My name, the man said, is Hermann Prinz. I am a lawyer representing the Kravitz family, and I apologize for giving you a fright.
He mopped his brow with a monogrammed handkerchief.
The guard on your gated street would not allow us to knock, and since you are not listed with a phone company, we could not call. My colleague, Francis here, facilitated access.
Your colleague's a burglar.
I'm a facilitator, Francis said with a Canadian twang. May I sit too?
No, you may not, Eric answered for me. You may keep your hands on your head, and if you move them, you may have your chest ventilated. Clear?
I remained standing, 4 feet from both men. One sat in front, one stood on my right. I said,
Get where you're going. Why are you here?
A case, Mr. Park. I have a case for you.
I'm not taking cases.
It is a case for which you are almost singularly suited.
English may not have been his first language, but his vocabulary was almost better than mine. I said, "Then it's probably crooked, illegal, or at least immoral. Leave now, and I'm keeping the Canuck's gun."
"It is not without rewards."
"Do I look like I'm struggling for money?"
"Not financial rewards. In fact, it is your current healthy bank balance that means you are the best person for this offer of employment."
I frowned, shuffled to my right, and rubbed my neck. Eric sidestepped for a better angle. Oops, I was shielding the older man, Herman, although I doubted he would prove much of a physical threat. Clearly, Eric was a more cautious type. Could be why he was an ex-soldier, and I was just a sometimes private investigator. I took the hint and held still. "What exactly does my bank balance have to do with this?" Herman crossed his legs and leaned back into the goose-down cushions, hands clasped in his lap.
"The previous investigator, tasked with examining a certain family tree, was the sudden recipient of an anonymous cash gift, and has since started a new life in Belize with a rather fetching young lady many years his junior."
"Genealogy. There are firms who specialize in those matters." The lawyer smiled, his face forming deep lines from his mouth up to his forehead.
"Mr. Park, if someone hires an investigator to assess the accuracy of a family's ancestors, but this investigator is bribed with a life-changing amount of money, what is your immediate conclusion?"
I sat in my reading chair, a wide number with chunky arms and natural light cast from behind. If he was bribed to stop looking, somebody's trying to hide something.
"And that someone is making life very difficult for a young woman. A girl, actually."
Herman creaked forward, elbows on his knees.
"Estelle Kravitz is 13 years old and is convinced she is not the true heir to the Kravitz fortune. And if she is correct, a lot of people stand to lose out."
"And why does she think she isn't the true heir?" I asked.
"Because, Mr. Park, she believes she is possessed. Possessed by a spirit who demands she tell the truth."
Chapter 2. After Francis and Eric patched up their differences and went out for a walk, skipping along the beach hand in hand, I hoped, I brewed coffee and invited Herman to the back terrace, where the patio doors had been accessed via brute force and the lock lay in pieces on the ground. Most in this gated community armed their houses with alarms and panic buttons, but my landlord never felt the need, what with a fence, a gate, and a guard on duty 24/7. I'd pass on my notes shortly. Herman sipped the long espresso and nodded appreciation. I took the chair opposite, and he lowered the cup to its saucer. "A ghost," I said.
"A spirit."
"Whatever the technical difference is, I'm a detective, not an exorcist."
"It really doesn't matter. Your brief is simply to clarify the family tree, not prove or disprove something scholars have been unable to agree upon for millennia."
"You just told me my client is a possessed teenage girl." Herman breathed heavily through his nose.
"Perhaps if I elaborate on the circumstances?"
I sipped my coffee, not enjoying it as much as I usually do, overlooking the long narrow garden under a cloudless blue sky.
"Since her mother's death 10 years ago, a great deal of money has sat in trust for Estelle. It will filter through to her in increments, depending how long her father lives. Eventually, she will control over 75% of the family fortune."
"And who are the Kravitz?"
"Kravitzes? I say that right?"
Herman adjusted his position. For the first time, he really looked his age, as if anticipating the conversation to come would drain him. Perhaps I was the only person in the world for whom Kravitz meant nothing more than an awesome musician.
He said, "Judge Gottfried Kravitz works out of the city of Hamburg, but also closely with the European Commission of Human Rights, most recently regarding the case of a 90-plus-year-old former Nazi administrator detained under a European arrest warrant. You are familiar with the case?"
"Vaguely. Hit some headlines a few months ago. Something to do with his rights being violated if they moved him from Italy, where his family lives."
Actually, his family are claiming their rights would be violated. His rights are inconsequential in this respect, but the matter has no relevance anyway. I know this. When I worked in Berlin, I used to prosecute such men myself.
Private pays better.
Chasing old men and women who will be dead soon anyway, it adds little to the world. I merely seek to emphasize Judge Kravitz is an important and respected man.
I'll take your word for it.
Good, good.
It wasn't clear if he misunderstood my lack of giving a crap.
But he married into the Kane line, whose wealth was generated largely from the art world, and although he is moderately well off as a judge, he is not, shall we say, an establishment figure.
Meaning the majority of his money comes from his late wife.
From Helena, correct. And he likes his lifestyle as it is. However, my concern is for the well-being of his daughter.
Estelle.
Yes, my fees are covered by her mother's estate, so I work for Estelle, not Gottfried.
I'd finished my coffee, the downside of short, strong drinks.
This is the haunted girl.
Ignoring my sarcasm, he said,
"A month ago, Estelle went missing from Kohani Dom."
Kohani Dom?
The family's estate north of Hamburg. It means sweet home in Polish. The family is originally from Poland.
Right.
She had a dream. She was inconsolable for days after. Her great-grandmother, Katerina, she soothed the girl. Helped with the doctor's examination when she would not allow her father near. But after many sleepless nights, Estelle slipped out. The police were called, naturally, and the German press sold a lot of advertising space as a result, but they made no progress in finding her. A sighting in Glinda, a CCTV image in Zeewetal, and when they sent experts to dredge a stretch of the Elbe River, well, you should have seen the headlines. Strangely, those days, when they thought her body may be discovered, the news was far louder than when she showed up 5 days later, alive and unharmed. Of course, the press do not know where she was found.
Where was that?
Krakow, he said.
Poland. Coincidence she chose the family's country of origin.
It is also where Vera and Marco Laporte live. Vera leads a Romani group, manages a site there. Has done for the past 4 years, since her husband's death.
Could his death be related to any of this?
Doubtful. He was killed by protesters outside a temporary camp. A neo-Nazi group wanted to move them on, and things got out of hand.
Okay, so Estelle found this Vera, then?
She caught 3 trains, using only a photo ID and cash, but we brought her home without the need for fanfare. The newspapers learned nothing of her claims of spiritual possession.
And the other investigator? I asked.
Tony Luca, a German-Italian fellow who came recommended from a friend's law firm. He worked on the assignment for less than a week after Estelle came home and announced he was ready to make his final report. Then he disappeared. The sudden injection of cash into his account and its equally sudden movement to a Cayman's bank. Add to that his social media account filling up with photos of his new beach home, and we can safely say he was handsomely compensated for burying whatever he found.
Gottfried, I said. Sounds like he'd have the most to lose.
Indeed, and the family's money has a wide reach.
Eric's voice carried through the border hedges with Francis's alongside. Not heated, just chatting. Maybe they'd become best buddies after all, patrolling the perimeter of their respective charges' positions between properties. I picked out mention of Iraq and guessed they were comparing service records. Still. Why the muscle? I asked. Missing girl, dodgy family background, doesn't add up to your life being in danger. He clasped his hands together, his old man discomfort pushed aside, the hawk-like lawyer back in charge.
Mr. Park? You are a man of ill repute, consorting with gangsters and terrorists. He was here to protect me from you.
Why do I get the feeling if I'd returned home without Eric, our conversation would have taken place down the barrel of a gun? The lawyer shrugged innocently. So she was fine, I said. Apart from the sticky-fingered PI, I hear another but in the distance.
They found her because a phone call was placed by one Vera Laporte, an elder of the Romani Laportes.
Again, you assume I know who they are.
You know of the Romani?
Gypsies, I said. Or travellers, whatever the modern term is.
Different people have different terms. They favour Roma in this case. The Laportes originated in Poland, driven into hiding by the Nazis in 1938 and 39.
Poland again, I said. They have a claim on the fortune.
Herman stood, rubbed his lower back, and stepped forward stiffly.
Forgive me, but I cannot sit in one position for more than 10 minutes at a time. Will you walk?
My garden, for such a nice house, was relatively small, but it rarely bothered me. I was a beach guy and always had been, and far preferred dining, drinking and reading on the balcony overlooking the sea. A squat palm plant grew in the centre of the gravel lawn, and the flower beds were empty, although I planned on using them as vegetable plots, if I stuck around long enough.
Herman held one of the palm fronds between a thumb and forefinger.
Estelle actively sought them out, the Laportes. She claims her great-grandfather, Petre Kane, or Peter, now occupies a portion of her soul and asks her to right a terrible wrong.
And you think the Roma are influencing her?
I think my client wants the truth.
Not sure how much help I can be here, Herman. I find missing people. I review criminal cases. He let go of the plant.
You perform background checks, and you know the systems and software, and you have a keen mind, despite your more unsavory associates.
I wandered slowly to the end of the garden, demarked by a thick tangle of orange trees, the branches knitted so closely together I couldn't push through and fall to my death on the rock-strewn beach, even if I ran at them full pelt. What exactly do you need me to do? Prove she's mentally ill?
No, Herman said. My client wishes to clarify her heritage, and having spent time with Vera Laporte, she is even more adamant she should not receive the money.
But what if it turns out she's right? What if, daft notions of the supernatural aside, what if the money really should go to the Roma?
Herman shrugged.
Then the truth will out, Mr. Park. I will be paid for my services, and most likely let go. But that is my job.
And Judge Kravitz?
He is confident the claim is nonsense and that Estelle is just a troubled young woman.
I headed back toward the house, allowing Herman to set the pace, which was not particularly brisk.
And how much are you paying for all this?
Expenses only, Herman said with a modest dip of his head. Despite the company you keep, we understand you are independently wealthy and only take cases where you feel compelled to help. Remuneration will be pointless in persuading you, but your inability to be bribed makes you valuable.
Confession time. This guy was stoking my ego, and I was having a hard time resisting a huge grin because, for once, a facet I could be sort of proud of had brought someone to my door. It made me suspicious too, though. Perhaps he'd done more homework on me than he was willing to reveal.
So tell me, Mr. Park, is the notion of helping this girl appealing to your better nature, or do I leave you to enjoy this pleasant but rather dull life you've chosen?
Dull?
I'd set up all my small pleasures, coffee, reading, scotch, occasional female company, and continued my training, CV work, a beach gym, a half-hour bike ride away, the firearms coaching. But 5 months of this saw me rejuvenated mentally and physically, and if I was honest with myself, it was a tad too idyllic. The road was calling, and I planned to up sticks and move on anyway. Tourist season was fast approaching, and Phila Town, the capital of Parramatta, became a hedonistic nightmare in summer. My intent was to return to Britain, pack my VW camper and take off through France, aiming for Italy or someplace farther out, and get to know myself again. Travelling was my passion, my lifeblood, and I was itching to move on.
but with no serious impetus to do.
Sample complete. Ready to continue?